Brown, just
that's fine.
That's helpful.
That's fine.
Thank you.
But 10 minutes, max.
Okay.
I'm going to start using an alarm clock.
Okay, so this is not an official PowerPoint presentation. This is just a collection of random pictures that were relevant to my topic. So I'll start off by saying why I wanted to write this paper. And the reason that I did was because I was intrigued throughout the whole 2012 obsession in popular culture. And that brought to my attention the fascinating Mayan civilization and how advanced they were, but also barbaric. So, of course, there's a natural attraction to things like that, and it made me want to look into their system a little bit more. So I thought I would start by addressing one of the subjects that wasn't touched upon as well in my paper as I would have liked, which is the sources for the information that we have at the present time. And as I referenced, in the 16th century, most of everything was destroyed by the Spanish conquistadors because of the hedonistic, or I shouldn't say hedonistic, but the barbaric practices of the Mayan people that they observed. They systematically rooted out their priests and elites and summarily executed them and drove their religion underground. So the main source of information that we have is from buildings that survive, which would be the temples. There are a bunch of hieroglyphs that appear on the temples that recent efforts have begun to decipher. Another source of information comes directly from the Spanish themselves. This is Diego de Landa, whom I cite frequently. And he has been responsible for an account of the Mayan people that he observed in the 16th century during the conquest. And also we have codices that have survived, that's pictured in the upper right-hand corner. And they're basically picture books with hieroglyphic text and depictions of various deities and rituals. And then the last source of information are the Mayan people themselves. And they are led by their shamans, because those were the only ones that were able to escape execution. And they have preserved many of their traditions, and of course, arguably, some of that may not be the same as it was back then. So that's where our sources come from.
How well have we translated the written language? Will two different, given a page of hieroglyphs looked at independently of two different people, will they interpret them the same or not? Do we know?
In several different texts on the subject, a lot of things remain consistent as far as the account of their civilization and their lives. There might be varied nuances.
What about the text? I'm talking about the source.
The text itself. The
written material. A lot of this is dependent on either the written codices or the stuff written on stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell, and maybe you don't know, but I'm sort of very curious, is this a matter of scholar A says it says this, scholar B says it says that, or is it a matter of, like the translation of, say, Latin, that we've got a pretty clear and unambiguous idea of what words mean?
Now, to more directly answer your question, I guess I don't know 100%, but what I can deduce is that the accounts seem to be fairly consistent. Now, with that introductory quote that I put in my paper from the Popol Vuh, that was actually, there are two different translations that I came across. I just like that one better.
How different are they?
In substance, they are not different.
Because when I was looking at Hammurabi's code a long time ago, and you have two different texts,
mm-hmm.
and they're different laws. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I can't tell in these how close that is to that.
As far as the laws are concerned, how they're described has been fairly consistent. There might be a minor difference that you'll notice where, I believe I wrote, they might sell one of their slaves to the victim's family, where in practice it may mean that they give them or sell them at a dramatically reduced price.
No, I was just thinking of the language itself.
And the language itself, I don't think so. As far as substances.
Presumably there was nobody surviving at this point who could read the language.
There were scribes. That's where the codices came from.
Scribes alive now?
No, not alive now. No. Everything's been filtered through the Spanish, basically, or for the most part, except for the recent efforts by archaeologists.
So it's a matter of modern people reconstructing the language with no Rosetta Stone.
Correct.
Right.
At least for as much as I know, yes?
This like, is the language, like, in the form of pictograms, like this, or?
It's hieroglyphs and pictograms, so it's kind of, there's, like, hieroglyphic text. I can go back a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Same, right there, so we'll have pictures. Yeah, it is pretty cool.
I learned the top, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what those individual symbols were? Are they sounds? Are they meanings?
They're, when they're written out, they're phonetic, kind of. I don't know the proper terminology, but they're kind of phonetic.
So it's like an alphabetic system?
Yes.
There's a theory that they're phonetic.
Are you the other author? Oh, great. Perfect. You're here. And he went into this a lot in his paper, which I can
Well, then we, will pull, then we will push these questions.
Yeah, defer
in,
to him.
So
we'll the experts.
That's fine.
So as far as the Mayan social structure, not to go too much into everything that was already discussed in my paper, but they did have a social structure that was rigidly enforced through a caste system that was based on lineage, and lineage was jealously guarded. There were a certain subset of elite lineages that would be the only ones that were able to hold office or rule, and those were often imitated as well, as I discussed later, and then they had a process in place.
By imitated, you mean the people who claimed to be of such lineage and weren't.
Absolutely. And then I addressed that in the interrogation of the chiefs, where the Halak eunuch, the local leader, the local ruler, would interrogate, gather all the chieftains together, and ask them questions about their certain occult knowledge that would supposedly have been passed down from generation to generation within a particular lineage. So that was one way, of course not all of them, one way that we know that they were able to kind of enforce the legitimacy. But lineage permeated every aspect of their culture.
You call it a caste system.
Yes.
You're describing it in terms of a very small number of divisions. And the Indian caste system is what we get the word from. You've got four broad divisions, but you then got an enormous subset in which probably, my guess is that if your father was a baker, you're supposed to be a baker. If your father, and that's all within a single caste, broadly defined. Do we know if that's true here?
There were, the three main subsets were elites, which would be your rulers, your kings, your local, down to your local government. Then we have the commoners.
And among the commoners,
was there a system?
That's right, do we know?
Not entirely sure. We do know there was a socioeconomic difference within the commoners. Some of them through highly specialized skills, or particularly being particularly shrewd merchants, would actually become quite wealthy.
True of us too, but we don't call that a caste system.
Exactly.
But you do say that among the elite, offices went in lineages.
Yes.
So that's sounding a little bit more like it, though not exactly. Anyway.
It was kind of informal. It depended on who was in power at the time, because they would be appointing all of their family members within their lineages across the different levels of government. So that's kind of how it would work. And then if there was a dramatic shift in leadership later on, then obviously you've got a whole new set of leaders.
But if I'm the fifth cousin of the ruler,
mm-hmm.
and my father was the tax collector for a certain town, do I get to be the tax collector for that town?
Yes. From what we know, titles and positions were also passed down through heritage. So, I guess I should use the word caste system, but who knows. That permeated every aspect of their culture. And let's see here.
Was it possible for somebody from the middle caste to become elite?
Absolutely. Yes, commoners, wealthy commoners through particular distinction in the military service, particular prowess in battle. Not just service in the military.
What about going the other direction? Are there ways in which elite become not elite?
As far as the elite, I don't think so. I know that they were shamed and treated particularly cruelly if they committed crimes. I don't think their status reduced. And I believe that and please, anyone offer your input, I believe that this is a result of their strict belief in the distinction of their lineage. They would trace their, to legitimize their rule, they would trace their lineage to either a distinguished individual, a warrior, or someone who had distinguished themselves, or to a deity. And that was especially true with kings. So I'm thinking that for that reason, they wouldn't want to demote them, if you will. But you could become a slave. That was
because you would expect that since the elite usually are better fed and better taken care of than the commoners, that they would steadily, that unless you had a way of getting people out of it, they would steadily increase in numbers and eventually everybody would be elite, which is the only thing that happened. But I'm kind of curious about the mechanism.
You know why? Because of probably all the constant warfare. So you've got a bunch of them getting killed off
and
all the way as
the army is all elites?
No, the army are not elites. The leadership of the army are elites. Or, as I mentioned, the NACOM was a particularized position.
But why does that kill more elites than more anybody else?
Why does that kill? Because when you invade another polity, you're going to take all of the elites with you as prisoners of war and use them as subjects for human sacrifice. So that kind of shrinks their population a little bit. And the Mayan were constantly in a state of warfare throughout their history. So that could have been one way. And then slavery, I did want to say, that was kind of a temporary status, and it wouldn't persist. It wouldn't be passed on from father to son. And you could go into slavery for being in debt for too long of a time, or if you were a prisoner of war, but then you were often executed. And I was going to ask everyone, why do you think the slavery status didn't pass to children, and particularly in the case of a prisoner of war, wouldn't you think that the child would be bitter against the government or against the local polity, and you would want them to remain a slave and therefore not participate in society?
Well, I think if you kept the children as slaves, they might be bitter. Yes, and they could, you know, then, you know, inside the slave uprising, which I think is, you know, because. I'm not sure about this, but slavery was a huge portion of the population. You know, I don't know about a majority, but there were a ton of them. You know, and so I think that possibly they could have reasoned that, the children of sacrifice people would be more dangerous as slaves than as freedmen, especially if they had if their parents were elites and they had, you know, something to go back to in some way. If they get back, they could inherit their parents' property or whatever.
But were there? You're saying that there were no slaves of whom it was true that their children were automatically slaves?
From what we know.
So that's unusual.
I think that's unusual as well. If that's truly the case, and it could just be a gap in my research, but.
Yeah.
I do think that's interesting because you would think you'd want to continually subjugate, and then also you'd want, as a slave owner, it would be more profitable for you to have them remain that way. So, yes?
I have a question. In the slave section, I might have read wrong, but you said that if somebody married a slave, then they would also become
yes.
a slave? Did that happen frequently enough? Because it seems like you would just find someone else.
Not a slave. I don't know. The heart wants what it wants.
We don't know how bad being a slave was. It might be that you were already sort of at the bottom of the free population,
yeah.
and being a slave, somebody would feed you and house you, and they might be willing to go for freedom.
Might be pretty good.
And there were parents, as is common in a lot of cultures, would sell their children into slavery as well. Poor people, impoverished.
Okay.
So it could be better
right.
for them. And yes, it must have happened enough, because we know about it.
Yeah.
So. But as far as how often, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah,
it is. It is.
I think
strange.
There's a Chinese rule along those lines, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I remember that coming up. So next I wanted to bring your attention to the religious beliefs, since these were the basis for their rulership and the basis for their laws. As I mentioned, the Mayan believed that all things were a part of a single existence with invisible aspects and physical aspects, and that all objects within the world possess a sacred or supernatural quality. In humans and animals, this was believed to dwell within the blood, which was called the kul, I believe, or kul, and that was the reason for all of their bloodletting and how prevalent that was in a lot of their rituals. So I did want to also talk about the most interesting part, which was the human sacrifice. This was something that was shocking, and I thought that only I didn't know that it came exactly from the Mayans. I thought the Aztecs were the only ones, but actually what I found was that the Aztecs influenced the Mayans, and later that led to more human sacrifice. And what was so important about this, I believe, and please offer your input, I believe that the reason that they did this, not only because it reinforced the divinity of the king, but also I think it was an effective way to maintain their rulership of their subjects. And what do you think?
Professor?
Oh, you, I'm sorry. I don't, what's your name?
Vlad.
Huh?
Vlad.
Vlad, hi, Christine. Because I know you mentioned this a little bit in your paper, and I think that it was an effective way to kind of, because the religious beliefs were so entrenched within the population, I think it was an effective way to kind of subjugate their citizenry.
I agree.
Do we know how the people, other than the captives, how they were chosen? There's this talk about leading somebody through the town and then sacrificing them and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know whether, was it a random selection? Was it?
We do know that sometimes people would volunteer their children or members of their family because it was particularly honored. As a matter of fact, on the previous slide, this is Ishtab, who is the goddess of suicide. So we do have accounts of women that would throw themselves upon the altar and cut their throats as a way to offer themselves to their gods. It was the most bloodletting and self-sacrifice were the most sacred of rituals, and they were used for the most direst of circumstances because the blood was considered so potent that it would appease the gods more than any other offering. Yes?
So now, did they do the bloodletting in order to kind of fend off natural disasters, or did
yes.
they do it in response to natural disasters?
It was in response, and it was also, they would have divination practices beforehand where the priests would kind of get high, basically, and foretell when we needed a ceremony to prevent what disaster and what the gods specifically wanted, whether it was human sacrifice or whether it was gold or jade or food or animal sacrifice, exactly.
Hmm.
So that's how we know. Yes?
I'm sorry, I totally forgot a question.
That's okay, it happened to me.
I guess one explanation could be that there really isn't a function, but that's just based in like religious belief. You know, the practice is just based in
religious belief. Yeah, the religious beliefs were deeply entrenched.
Hmm.
Every person, down from the king down to the commoner and serf, would be incredibly devout.
How do you know that?
We know that from our accounts. I've read in probably four or five different sources the same thing.
And how do they know it?
I don't know. And I'm presuming that's because of the...
Because after all, if you imagine that all you have from civilization is the official writing, you think about the stuff on the stone,
mm-hmm.
that might give you a very, very biased picture.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
History is written by the victors.
Yeah. And in particular, the point, I've seen the argument made with regard to medieval European history,
mm-hmm.
that we get a very biased picture because it's almost all written by clerics. And they naturally are looking at it from their point of view. There's a book, William Marshall, Flower of Chivalry, I think, by a French medievalist, who points out that in the case of William Marshall, very prominent 12th century knight, we have an biographical poem written from within the chivalric class, not from within the priestly class. And it gives a noticeably different angle on what that society looked like. And so I'm just wondering whether, how sure we are, that it's presumably the three sources we've got. You've got the inscriptions on the stone,
mm-hmm.
and that I wouldn't trust for statements about how much people believe in their
religion.
Well,
those are...
You've got the codices, which might or might not, depending on how detailed they are, and they might say, well, you know, we had a trial of somebody who didn't believe in their religion, and we killed him or something, or they, and then you've got the surviving versions of the culture, and you maybe have some measure of how deeply those people believe.
And, of course, that could be altered by the fact that they've been in oral tradition for 500 years.
Yep.
So it naturally can change. Yeah.
One more question. How does a religion relate to subjugation of the people?
I was just commenting on the rituals themselves. And also another thing I did mention, too, was the fact that their towns and cities were modeled after the cosmos. The palace would be in the center of the town, and then radiating outward And so kind of what that goes to is giving people the security of knowing that they live in a cosmologically ordered society, and that also each thing was represented within the city. So in the north, to represent the heavens, you would have the king's burial grounds, and then at the center of the palace to represent the core of the earth and the center of their society. So that kind of leads to a daily reminder of how important your rulers are, if that answers your question.
Okay, so it's kind of just symbolic.
Symbolic, and it's how does anybody subjugate people? I mean, you can use force, but the most potent way is probably mental, psychological, and religious coercion, and that's kind of where I think they were most effective. So, anyways, we'll move on to...
What was that? Is that their sport?
This was the ball court, and this is Indiana Jones with the heart removal.
Okay.
Just in case you're wondering, yes, this is in Chichen Itza on the left, and that's the hoop that a lot of people recognize from popular culture.
And do we know, how much do we know about the ball game?
We know a lot. We know that it was modeled after the story of the hero twins, and I'm going to defer to my classmate because I know he discussed this a lot. But it was modeled after the story of the hero twins, which is also in the Popol Vuh sacred book, in their creation story. And it was used to, sorry, I'm trying not to tread too much on your territory, but it was used to reinforce the particular king's power. Sometimes they would use it as a symbolic victory, where they would reenact their victory over an opposing polity, and then sacrifice the elites from the other polity at the end. It's interesting. So, with the Maya rulers, the king was at the very top, and he would legitimize his rulership through divine ties and an elite lineage. Their courts follow a court paradigm, which most of us might be familiar with from medieval European societies, where everything was focused on the palace and the king. And then you would have people competing with each other to get close to the king and gain power. Everything flowed from and to the king, and that was how people would become rich and gain their lands and gain subjects. So then, moving down to the local government, chieftainship they were appointed by the kings, again, along the lines of lineage. At the very top was the Halek eunuch, and then he, in turn below him, appointed the Batab, who are most important to our discussion because they acted as the judge of their division. And
remember, everybody's supposed to have read your paper.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's talk about the laws in general, because what I found interesting was that it was very localized, and it was issued only by the Batab. And it was supposed to be loosely based on law that would have been passed down from the king and the priests. But what do you guys think? I think that it could have been open to a lot of interpretation and manipulation based on that individual ruler's needs.
The Batab is the local governor below the level of the king?
Yes.
Do we know how many there
are? There's the king, and then there's the Halek eunuch, and then there's the Batab. And he's like the division.
So wait a minute. The Halek eunuch is for the whole kingdom, or are there a bunch of them?
They were like divided kind of into smaller groups within the city, and then there would be a Halek for each one, and then there was the main king at the top.
And how do we have any idea how many Batabs there are for one city state?
I have no idea.
Whether it's sort of the local town?
It is a division or a district, so we can imagine that there were quite a few. And then they all would, before deciding a complex case, they would go up to the Halek and confer with him. And then there was also, they relied on a council as well to come up with their decisions. So,
And this is all within a single city or within an area ruled by a single city? Are your Batavs separate because one of them is 20 miles that way and one of them is 20 miles that way? Or are they, you know, like here and half a mile here and half a mile here all within the same city?
I don't imagine, from what I gather, I don't imagine there would be a bunch of them, but to serve the needs of their community. So it might be either geographically based or population based or a combination of both. And they were appointed by the Halak. So.
I have a question for
you,
Professor. Professor, do you think there's any linguistic ties between the Halak in Mayan civilization and the Jewish Halak that engages in jurisprudence?
No, I don't believe that the lost tribes of Israel are back quite that far.
the Polynesians got a long way across the Pacific. That's much harder than that, didn't they?
So, they would act as the judge and jury, and they would review the evidence, and the Mayan did distinguish between accidental and deliberate acts. There was also another classification for crimes that offended the gods, such as rape or murder or incest or things like that that would be more met with swifter punishment. And, as I mentioned, pardons were available, and presumably for a price, if the offender went to the victim's family, they could potentially pay them off to receive lesser punishment. Yes?
Sorry, confused. So it would be the king at the
mm-hmm.
top, and then he chooses the eunuchs, and the eunuchs choose the
mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's all within a particular lineage, so it would be in their best interest, presumably, to keep everyone within the same lineage.
So the eunuchs are also part of that lineage?
Yes. Okay. They're like cousins or somewhere along those lines, is it their family? It's like a dynastic system, kind of.
And we're talking about eunuchs, like, what they removed from the dynasty.
I'm sorry, what?
Eunuchs?
No, it's just a word in the Mayan language.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Nothing to do with our word E-U-N-T-O-C.
Family, entire family do that. Okay.
Okay.
So the Halak, they serve kind of like a legislative, judicial, and executive.
Not really judicial.
Oh.
It was more of a legislative executive type of situation. And
when you committed a crime, do you go to the local Halak? Or sorry, if
the
top.
The top is the community level guy. So, and then he also has two piles who are like constables.
But how do you get caught? Do we know what the enforcement is?
That's another thing I was going to ask everyone. I presume that it would be a private enforcement system where the individual would have to complain to a Tupil or to an official to bring them before the Batav.
But we don't know.
But we don't. I don't know. I don't know, and that's what I would think. And I also mentioned a state law where it passes from father to son, and then they also, I found it interesting that they had a conservator trustee type of arrangement for a child that was too young to inherit. And the actual distribution of their estate was done publicly, like a probate court today, to ensure that there was no shenanigans going on.
And was there freedom? Was there testamentary freedom, or was there a legal rule that determined who inherited? Do we know?
Oh, it was a legal, customary kind of rule. We don't know if that we can tie it to a particular law, like no surviving law code, but that was the customary way that they would inherit, and women would only inherit as a matter of good favor. And they had no legal right.
But the person who was dying could not say, I want to leave half my money to so-and-so who's a friend.
Oh, yes. That's how women would inherit, if they wanted to.
Could you believe it to anybody? That is, some societies...
It was expected that it would pass from father to son. And if the person who was dying, I guess, said something about the woman, or maybe it was the surviving relatives that decided whether or not to inherit her.
Could the person who was dying say, I've got two sons, this is the one I want it all to go to?
No, but we do know that, so that is a good question, whether or not it was an actual will, who actually decided.
Some legal systems have testamentary freedom,
right.
Including 49 and 50 states in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And some have some legal restriction on the amount to which you've got to leave money.
Mm-hmm. We have that as far as forced in community property or non-community property states where there's a forced share to a spouse.
I was thinking of Louisiana. There is old, basically, rules coming, I guess, only from Roman law. But anyway, but you have to, you don't know whether they had testamentary freedom or not.
I don't know. I know that the scholars have described their customs, and that's how it was typically done, and we don't know if they've changed it or not, but presumably there was some freedom. But we don't know if it was the testator himself or his surviving relatives that decided. So as far as the criminal law, I did already talk about that with the pardons. And then with theft, restitution would be slavery or to pay back your debt. And punishments were passed to family members. So that would provide incentive for them to help you out to get out of the situation. And then nobles were treated especially harsh, like we saw with the Chinese law. And then for adultery...
all of this is in your paper.
Yes, it is. Well, then why not? Yes.
So you have one part in there that talks about... now, a contract becomes enforceable when they take a drink together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's unsuitable to become alcohol.
It's alcohol. It's called Balche, I believe is how you pronounce it. And it's a certain type of bark from the Balche tree fermented with honey. And it was a specific drink that was incredibly potent, not like the alcoholic drinks we would think of today. It was like hallucinogenic almost, I guess. And they would drink that to formalize their contracts.
Okay, so like, to what extent in your research did you come across anything that talks about breach or like consequences of breach?
That was overseen by the Fatah. And the reason... it wasn't entirely discussed in great detail in what I came across, but the fact that they are judicially enforceable means that presumably they would be able to go to the top and have the top overseeing who would need to make restitution at home. But that was their way of creating a legally enforceable contract.
I had a bunch of questions.
Oh, okay.
One of them is you talk about the Wei and the Nagual, and I couldn't tell whether they were two names for the same thing or different or
different. No. The Nagual is a spiritual companion, like the name, like in a lot of Native American cultures we've seen, or not we, but everyone's come across them, where you kind of had a spirit companion animal. And then the Wei was kind of their concept of, let me go look. It was like a way of life, I think. They were talking about.
Judging by your paper, at least, it looked as though it was a Mayan word for something.
Oh,
real,
yeah.
It, I didn't figure out.
Yeah, let me. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm just trying to find how I distinguish the two of them. Oh, you know what? Yeah, that might have been the same thing. That was the two different words for the exact same thing. I apologize. Depending on which region the Mayan came from, some of the actual terminology varies.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
You say activity that will be considered evil in one time may be entirely appropriate in another. You gave no examples. So
oh, sure. Certain crimes,
what crimes would be?
Like if you were burning your, I guess this wouldn't be a crime necessarily, burning your fields in the wrong cycle was considered kind of a crime. And then if you did it in the appropriate cycle, it would not be a crime. So that was all influenced by the priest's divination.
Which of the two cycles is this? Is this the 365-day cycle or the 200-and-some-day cycle?
The 200-and-some-day cycle. Because
if it was a 365-day cycle, we got rules like that, too. Like, when you're dry, you're not supposed to...
This is on the... And I think I referenced that, too, at one point. Khatun, where it's a little bit over 19 years or something, and that was a different cycle within a cycle. So,
another sort of set of linked questions is what limited the size of apologies? That is, it sounds from everybody seems to agree you never had a single Mayan empire.
That's correct.
You did have fairly sizable polities, I think 400,000, one of you cited. And I didn't see any very clear explanation of why the equilibrium was many rather than one. Why didn't you have a successful one gradually grow and absorb the others?
I think I mentioned one of the polities that got pretty big, over 60 square miles. I can't remember where exactly I had mentioned it. But it was closely tied to the success of the particular king.
So why didn't you, you had several, you, this is a system that lasted for, what, 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
At no point in that time did you have a king who was successful, or two generations or three generations of successful kings?
To completely unify the empire?
Why not?
Why not?
You don't know.
I don't.
Fine.
I don't know.
The legitimate answer
it
is...
It was tied, no, that's fine. I'm just trying to, yeah. It was tied to the king, and for presumably it's because they didn't survive. Or
Alexander, Majesty, you would unify a much larger empire.
In a lot shorter of a time period.
Yes. Another question is, can we tell anything about the potential conflict between the king and the military? Are there any military coups reported, for example?
No, nothing that I've come across. The Nakam was appointed by the council or the king himself for some particular, either he came from an elite lineage or he was a particularly fierce soldier. So presumably he was kind of controlled by them.
But then what if he is a successful general, he wins a war, he's got all these soldiers who are loyal to him, there's the River Rubicon.
They were only appointed for a 3-year term or to fight a particular war. So they never went on to continue.
3 years is a fairly long time. How long did it take Caesar to conquer Gaul?
You tell me.
Any less than 3 years.
No, it took him a really long time. I'm not sure.
Doesn't sound right, but in any case, I'm just thinking of one of the cases where you've got a successful military conqueror who then seizes power.
Nothing has trickled down to us. So
we have no evidence of that happening.
We have no evidence of that happening, but who knows?
Yes.
It's all within the
One very minor question. You used the term heretic.
Yes.
Did you mean it actually heretic?
No, I went and Googled it after I saw your comment, and the appropriate word would have been pagan or Satan worshiper or...
Because the medievals did think of the Muslims as heretics, or at least some of them did. That Dante thinks that Muhammad is a heresiarch, a leader of a heresy, and it struck me as unlikely but not impossible that the, another question, you mentioned that they didn't have interest.
Correct.
Do we have any evidence beyond the fact that they have rules about it?
No. We don't have evidence of people cheating the system.
Or that they didn't.
Or that they didn't cheat the system. Well, we know.
Do we have any significant amount of evidence of what the forms of contracts?
I'm sorry. About
the forms of contracts. For some societies, you've got lots of surviving written contracts.
Contracts were not written; they were formalized. It was a formal kind of arrangement with the. He had a question first, if you don't mind.
Possibly to make an in-depth comparison, the comparison between, the reason why the Mayan city-states, stayed independent for so long, could have some similarities to the Italian system where, they basically did, all based on their fierce independence more than anything else, And it was just, they didn't suffer, foreign rulers lightly, even though they were subjected to the depredations of Austrians and French and Normans and, even the Genoese and Venetians, but still, the majority of the...
The Normans ruled half of Italy for quite a long time.
They did, but the South didn't have other cities. It was just... the South Pole was kind of an unorganized morass, and still kind of is, actually. But the central and northern city-states, they were economically powerful, and, the bigger powers around them constantly tried to conquer them and, incorporate them in their empires, and they always failed, with the exception of the Austrian
Empire. Not on you, I have a question. I have an idea, which might easily be wrong.
Sure.
But that is, both of you seem to agree that control of water was important.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if it would turn out that what kept the city-states from being smaller than they were was the area over which water mattered. If you imagine that water here affects water there,
right?
But water here and there doesn't affect water over there. So maybe what's going on is the sort of function of the city-state is to coordinate the use of water. It therefore grows up to the point where the area it's controlled is an area where the water sources are connected,
mm-hmm.
and maybe above that, I don't know what, that some disadvantages of large states take over. I was curious as to, is it at all clear what the relation is between the hydrology and the politics?
Right. And, that would probably be a better question for my colleague. Because I know that he addressed that a little bit more, but that's a fair argument. Another one was that particular polities enjoyed greater success from the obvious reason, economic resources. And then others for spiritual reasons, like being a coastal town associated with Shibolba, because the water was tied to Shibolba. Yep.
What about the contracts? those dreams were so strong, wouldn't that potentially harm the revelation?
But you're already done negotiating at that point, so it's a party afterwards.
No, but I mean, to remember the terms. I mean, did they have a whole bunch of witnesses as well?
I don't know. I know that the mechanism in place for formalizing a contract was the parties would drink.
Because it just seems like if it's explicit, then it could also mess with your ability to remember.
Oh, yeah, I understand that point. Presumably they'd be witnessed, but who knows?
I mean, going back to the point about why it was never unified, I was just thinking maybe there were practical barriers because of the topography and the nature of the land itself. I mean, like thick jungle. I mean, I don't know if you've come across this at all in research, but I mean, to what extent did they have like roads?
Oh, they did have roads.
Okay, so they were actually connected, very well connected.
Yes, there was a lot of travel.
Okay, so that's against my thought.
That was a good thought, though. So did anyone else have any other questions before I wrap up? I don't want to go into too much of my paper.
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
Nothing fancy. Oh, great pictures, though. Those are awesome.
Oh, thank you. I don't know how to turn this off.
Oh, it's fine.
I will turn it off.
Oh, thank you. That's fine.
Special filter somewhere?
No, but I think I have it. It's the one that's labeled off.
Hi, so my name is Lev, and I actually also researched the ancient Maya. So you've heard many things about them already, so I'll try and keep my my presentation here to things that maybe you haven't heard as much, or things that are really critical. So the first most important thing is the sources, and actually the lack of sources that we have for the civilization. Like Christine mentioned, there were codices, and during the Spanish invasion, Diego de Belanda, in a very kind of famous type of gesture, she burned 27 of these hieroglyphic codices. These were on bark paper. In comparison, we only have 4 partial codices now. So even though he wrote a book based on his travels and his accompanying the Spanish conquest, he pretty much destroyed about 98%, I believe, of knowledge about the Mayan day-to-day life. So another source that we actually use to find out how the Mayans operate on a political and societal level are the hieroglyphs. And mostly they were found on these stone pillars and stone temples. The pillars were called a stela. And each individual ruler would essentially erect these things, it seems like out of vanity, for many reasons. This would include the ruler's title, the ruler's ancestry. Usually it would trace back to some kind of divine lineage from their origin myths. And it would also list out some of the more important bureaucratic figures of that same area. So that shows us that they had a multi-tiered and bureaucratic system. But more importantly, from deciphering these stone hieroglyphs, modern sources have found what they call emblem glyphs. These hieroglyphs, these sources, or modern scholars think, depicted each town's and each kind of population's allegiance to a certain ruler, to a certain elite. And this is how we can pretty much get not only a sense of how large these empires or these city-states were, but also that there are many of them, and the chronology that went on between them, the constant alliances and the constant warfare that went on between them. For example, there's a super state theory, which I read. These two cities, they employed their own emblem gifts and glyphs, and nobody else in about a 60 mile area surrounding those cities didn't employ any other emblem glyphs. And that means that these two cities were essentially an alliance. And I think the estimate was about 400,000 people of the city-states.
This is 60 linear miles, not 60.
Square miles.
60 square miles?
Around the center of
capital. So in other words, an area 6 miles by 10 miles.
What's that?
An area 6 miles by 10 miles. That's what 60 square miles is.
Oh, in that case, it might be...
I mean, in that case, it might be more of a diameter type area.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned this.
Yeah, it's a diameter type.
Right.
Across.
Okay, right. And so these were quite large city-states, and a puzzle that we reached during the last presentation was how these city-states could remain autonomous. And I do want to go over the control of water that pretty much every single city-state utilized. Archaeologists have found reservoirs, hillside terracing, raised fields, drained swamps, and essentially signs of not only preservation but also distribution of the water. And I think this was a very powerful means to control the surrounding area. You said, Professor, this would depend on the particular area of that city, the geography around it. And it seems like the autonomy could be, there seems to be a kind of a efficient bargaining type situation here. It seems like when one ruler or one city spends so much resources to get the reservoirs and distribution system in place, they would, one, want the area around them to pay them royalty, to pay them money to use and give them allegiance to use those services. But it seems they would also be hesitant to actually enter into any really large-scale type warfare because they have so much already invested in their own distribution of water.
So why is that a reason not to conquer other people?
Well, it seems like you would always have the risk of your own infrastructure that you spent so much time and labor of that also being taken away from you.
They don't have that. Anytime you engage in a war, there's a risk the other guys will beat you, but that's true in all societies. But there's got to be something determining the equilibrium size of the state, and I don't know what it is.
Oh, I can add to that. Basically, the Mayans, on a large-scale basis where warfare was concerned, they did not practice slash-and-burn type warfare. They would keep the policies intact to work in for you.
What's funny is that the Inca had a similar hydrological issue, and they had to do lots of canal building, lots of terrace building, and there was a lot of, you know, management of the water sources. And it seems like they had a unified, empire over a vast region.
Much worse geography than
And it encompassed so many different geographical types of regions, so it seems like to say, just because of all this infrastructure, with all this investment in water, so you conquer an area and then you take control of the water and you redistribute it.
It might more explain their political back and forth. It doesn't quite explain why one really powerful city state didn't take over all the area. I did try to explore their beliefs, and their religion, as Christine mentioned. The whole cosmological order was very important. We do have a hard time determining how homogenized and how unified that belief was, but it really seems like this was something fundamental to essentially every polity in the area. And just to give you a flavor of this belief, the Mayans actually had two separate calendars. One calendar was a sacred round, 260-day calendar, and each day was actually its own deity. Another calendar was actually superimposed on top of this, and that was a more of a basic solar calendar. And so every 52 years, these were important dates, and then every 52 years, these calendars would intermesh on the same day. And so everything was seen as recurring. Everything was seen as things like migrations and droughts, seasons, even warfare was seen as recurring. And that meant that every individual, not just the ruler and not just the commoner, had an affirmative duty to please this cosmological order. And so it seems like, this is of course a stretch and, you know, really hypothesis, but it seems like a given ruler of a city-state would have more of a tolerance and actually more of a more of an idea of his, of the other rulers as kind of also fitting in into this cosmological order. So it wasn't as much as, say, the European mercantilism system where, you know, what's not mine should be mine, and that would make my wealth greater. It didn't seem like that was the paradigm. It seemed like wealth was also measured in this cosmological type of...
Didn't you describe it that there were conquests, and that there were some city-states that became patrons of others? So they were...
There was, but it seems like that might have been some kind of internal force.
What do we know about the other direction? Do we have accounts in these things of cities breaking up, of provinces seceding, of things? If you imagine a process where some things make things get bigger and some smaller, do we have any evidence on the smaller ones?
I'm sure it's out there. I'm sure it is. I haven't run across it. It should be there, and it should be non-speculative. Like I said, these rulers would actually trace their conquests, and it seems like one person's conquest is another person's defeat. So I'm sure situations like that took place, but the puzzle is that for the most part there was warfare, and there was also interaction, trade, alliances, but no single unified empire, no single conqueror.
You may have come across this in your research as well, but as far as kings and shifting sizes and polities, I don't know if you read about them displacing the other rulers and then humiliating them to basically demoralize the rulers because the Mayan people were so tied to the divine aspects of their king that they would demoralize the kings and then that way subjugate the new people as a way, instead of destroying everybody.
Yeah, but that does seem like there would be one kind of a conqueror king who would, you know, proclaim himself the most loved by the gods because he would conquer the most of the area.
Right, but then they would also throw him under the bus if for some reason there was drought or a bad year. They would also say that he had angered the gods. Well, at least that's what I came across.
Do we in fact have evidence of rulers themselves being sacrificed because of things going badly or not?
Not by the people, but by the other rulers.
Right,
it means everybody else conquers you.
Yes.
No, that... You were talking about when there was a drought, when the gods were angry. Do we have any evidence that if I'm the ruler and things go very badly, then I will end up myself getting killed?
I didn't find any specific.
Yeah, I could have said
because I think one of you mentioned a case where the ruler of a city was captured and they waited until he died 10 years later before they chose to speak.
You mentioned that.
And that was a beautiful. Getting captured is doing pretty badly, but that didn't seem to be sufficiently to replace him.
Yeah, and that's why it seemed to me like they were really tied to a kind of almost balance, almost a status quo. Things are correct the way they are.
But that doesn't explain how some cities conquered other cities.
Right, right. It does not.
Other things I wondered with regard to your sources. What do the codices actually say? What's in them?
The four that we have, I believe one is actually concerned with the two calendars. And that's how we have most of our information about the dates being important and how actually that codex actually prescribes rituals for essentially every single day of the sacred round. The other codices were dealing with similar things, astronomy.
So they don't tell us, so none of our political information is from the codices, that's all from the hieroglyphics on the stone.
Yeah. On the stones and temples.
Were all the codices burned?
We have four.
Four.
Yes, and they're partial too.
Do we know how many there were originally? I think you might have said that already.
We know that Diego de Londo burned 27. He gathered them up and he burned them as writings of the devil. So, what we're left with really, when it comes to the kind of day-to-day law of the Mayans, is that which was left behind for us from the Spanish conquest. And we can see that there are many distortions from that kind of viewpoint.
How much of this exists in the surviving Mayans? That's our other source. Our third source is the surviving ones. And I can't tell from either of your papers whether their existing societies really fit this pattern on a small scale, or whether what we have is only oral traditions that they say our great ancestors did this or what?
I didn't consider that. I think that would be actually a great kind of source to supplement what I have now, because there's kind of a gap between the classic period, between 300 AD and 900 AD, when all of these monuments were erected. That's where we know all of the information about the polities and about the city-states. There's a big gap of about 600 years until the Spanish come, and they tell us through their own lens, these were Spanish priests at the time in the 16th century, we get accounts from their lens of what was going on at that time. And so I think you're right. Fast forward 500 more years, there could be information, could be analogy between the modern.
I thought you were saying that was one of your sources.
Yeah, not personally, obviously, but accounts.
One of the sources of
anthropologists that go and
from their accounts, what are they actually learning? Are they actually observing institutions functioning, or are they observing oral tradition?
The Maya people of today are a shadow of what their ancestors were as far as their civilization. They're mostly local, small communities led by a shaman. And they'll preserve some of their religious.
Are there criminal rules, the rules that we have described?
We don't know about. And the thing is, we don't know because they're small groups, so it could very well be, but I didn't find anything directly.
But they identify themselves as the Maya people, though?
Yes. There's different subsets depending on what part of the
language. Why does the language survive? You know that?
The language? I'm trying to remember. I know that in the Popol Vuh version that I quoted, that was translated by Alan Christensen. He actually was with the Q-Shang Maya.
What was that from?
That was from one of the codices, I believe. I can't pronounce the right codices. And there's also another, the Popol Vuh comes from a particular Spanish friar, and he was the one, the champion behind preserving that text, and he translated it into Castilian Spanish.
So what we have, so what you were quoting was an English translation of a Castilian translation
of a Mayan text. So yes, there are a lot of different filters and hands on what we have.
Right. So I think one major puzzle is to try to figure out what these. What really the rules that would govern their life were. And I think that we can probably make at least a few generalizations from the similarities between classic period, between what we see from the Spanish, and between from the, modern Maya. But again, there are severe limitations on what we can actually project to the classic Maya period, in which the Mayas were actually most active. Building all of their infrastructure, building their temples, and actually that was the most prosperous time for the civilization. So the most interesting to find out how they actually functioned back then. But that is hard to project back in time. So I think one interesting thing that was relayed to us by the Spanish is the distinction between intentional torts, I guess, those committed with intent and with malice, and with those that were unintentional. And from what I could gather, it seems like those that were unintentional, those did not call for any kind of blood sacrifice, for any kind of however you say it. It's for example, homicide. If you kill somebody, you were essentially forfeiting your own life. The rulers would have the other family of the person who you killed actually kill you. However, if it was unintentional, then that kind of bloodletting would not be required, and you could make amends, restitution by either payments or slavery. Slavery was actually seemed to be really common for form of restitution.
Do we know whether everybody had the same price? How much does the amount I owe depend on who I kill, if at all?
Right. What I ran across only concerned kind of the other aspect of that, was if the person doing the wrong was an elite. In that case, they were punished more harshly. And for something
they owe more money?
Well, actually, they would owe blood sacrifice.
That doesn't do any good to the relatives of the victim. in terms of the compensation, the person who supposes an unintentional killing, if I understand the rule correctly, an unintentional killing, it's a capital offense if the family of the victim chooses it to be, and is a damage payment owed to the family of the victim.
I'm actually not sure if it could be pardoned. Do you recall that, Christine?
For an
unintentional
killing, it would be death at the hands of the victim's family. Or they could choose to pardon.
Right. So therefore, it's capital if they choose
not to.
But for compensation, do they know if there's a fixed schedule of compensation? If so, is it the same for everybody?
I have not run across that.
Because that's one of the things that varies across compensation systems, which is why I was curious about it.
It seems like there would be. But I haven't seen anything from that angle. The other angle is, for example, theft. And if the thief happens to be an elite, then he actually owes his own blood sacrifice. He has committed that much more of a wrong in the eyes of the deities, really, in the eyes of the order of the universe, that he has to sacrifice his own blood to therefore create balance in the universe again.
Can I correct my earlier statement?
Yeah.
When you were talking about the current people?
Yeah.
So for the text that I quoted from the Kodava, that was actually Alan Christensen receiving oral tradition, orally spoken words, and writing them down.
So we have no idea whether that's the text or whether that was actually...
We have another version of the Kodava, which says similarly, substantially the same thing with the change of...
From where?
And that one was the one that was translated by the Spanish in the 18th century.
18th century.
That particular version. Yeah.
So none of this goes back to the actual time of the conquest.
No, it did. That version was translated from Mayan texts that were prepared by Mayan scribes during the time of the conquest at the direction of the Spanish. So it could have been that they were.
Somebody in the 18th century who could read Mayan?
He was working with local people. This, I think it was Ximenez or whatever his name was. He was working with the local Mayan scribes that still existed at that time to translate the previous books that were written during the 15th century, or 16th century.
By the books, do you mean the codices were described?
And those were compiled by various different authors, like the Bible. Sorry.
No problem. Something interesting I want to add. You have the picture of the ball game. And this ball game was actually prevalent throughout the Mesoamerican ancient civilizations. There were variations of the rules, but usually it was done as a ritual. A lot of times it did mirror creation myths. It also mirrored great victories.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction between a game and I usually think of a ritual as more like a play. So do we know what the rules of the game were?
Yeah, that circle, the hoop, that wasn't actually the only way to score. Scoring was done by end zones and other complicated means. But
so what you're trying to do is to move a ball either through the hoop or to particular places.
You saw how high that hoop was. It's actually pretty impossible to get to it. They had to hit the ball with their hips, I suppose, and their thighs even.
And how big and heavy was the ball? What do we know about the ball?
It was about, I think, 10 pounds, actually, so it was pretty significant. And so if somebody made it through that hoop, the game was actually over immediately. And their prize, in a documented case, was the possessions of the spectators. It was that rare that the team that got it through that hoop was actually entitled to, well, all your stuff. So you can imagine that as soon as somebody scores, everybody flees the entire arena. are there more general questions about the mind?
Has that ever happened? That 10-pound ball within the...
Yeah, it's documented in their... I'm guessing in their... not in the hieroglyphs, but I guess it would be in the pictures. It's actually interesting that a lot of the depictions that the rulers made of themselves involved them with the ball present and somehow participating in this game. So it was clearly important, not just...
No, but did they actually go through the hoop?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
How do we know this?
That's the camel we have. So it could be...
Was it carved on the stone. That happened this time. I thought we were just told that what the codices were was not that kind of stuff, but things like astronomy and religious rituals.
No. So I guess I don't know how we know if that actually happened, but that was the purpose.
No, that is what some source said it was the purpose, and it was worth trying to figure out how they knew it. But it does seem to me when you're looking at this kind of thing, that you have to be sort of skeptical of the certainty of all of the accounts and try to figure out what the sources of information are. Because people, lots of contexts, guesses turn into facts very rapidly.
And especially when there are so many secondary sources and they're essentially recounting one person's deciphering, and it doesn't mean that that person's deciphering might be the correct one. I do wish that there was some kind of a primary source that was left over.
We need in
a, right. So that is a good question, though. It's a good question. I'll have to find out exactly how they know that it happened.
Another question along related lines. You've got a little bit by one of the Spanish sources describing how when things went wrong, they went to confess their sins to their priests. And I am immediately suspicious because, of course, confessing your sins to the priest is something the Spanish did.
Right.
Do we have any basis for telling whether that's a projection of their institutions or whether I guess you wouldn't know whether the current Maya confess their sins to their shamans when things go wrong?
No, I don't know that. I think that would be the best indication of the current Maya.
Yeah.
I am also quite skeptical of the accounts that the Spanish left over. But no, that was not mentioned in any other source besides from the priests themselves. You have a question?
Oh, I was just going to add a comment about it's a shame that we don't have a time machine. There are efforts are underway currently, and with each passing decade, we get better at deciphering the hieroglyphs. But then again, that still only leaves us with propaganda. But it is first-hand propaganda, so that might be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. And one might be able to check the consistency. That is to say, if we've got propaganda from two different sides,
mm-hmm.
see if there are cases where they're describing the same events and have
yeah.
different claims about what happened.
And we can call what it's...
In particular, do any of the stele I describe my side losing? That would be interesting.
Well, one thing we do have evidence of that I mentioned with the Chichen, it's the bowl of sacrifice. We did dredge it and find 50 human skulls.
Right.
And like you mentioned, there is a theory that actually their hieroglyphs are phonetic. It hasn't really been substantiated yet. So far, they're treating the hieroglyphs as own individual ideas, not as any kind of phonetical parts of a sentence.
Essentially words.
Right. So
if they don't know whether they're phonetic or whether they're ideographs, how can they possibly know what they say?
Well, I think they're ideographs just like, I'm not familiar with the ideograph term. It seems like they're very similar to those in the ancient Egyptians, for example.
Yeah, but they have no connection between the two. And how does one figure out what the symbol means without some Rosetta Stone or equivalent?
I don't know. I don't know how the deciphering happens. I know that the individual characters are essentially have their own independent meaning that is later kind of superimposed into not a sentence, but kind of the analogy would be a paragraph. So as far as the phonetical parts of longer words, that's a different theory that that modern scholars have.
Those two theories are going to give you entirely different readings of the same text, at which point no reading can be relied on.
Yeah, they're right. But the majority, or the classic theory, is the one that I think the majority, or if not all, of our secondary sources rely on. The phonetic theory is new. It's quite new, quite recent. Anything else?
All right. Well, we get to start Tuesday, I guess, with the whatever else I have.
Are we
going to
be able to finish all the papers?
Probably not. I don't assume so. We'll see how close we can come, but it depends on